House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to have, I think, a very interesting presentation, set of presentations today. And I want to start out by saying thank you to a lot of the people in the audience today who spent a significant amount of time to prepare presentations for this committee on Energy 101. So I hope this is good and useful information, and we're very grateful to all of the presenters today for taking the time to prepare the material for the committee and to help get us up to speed. But before we get there, we're going to do what seems like every committee we've been doing. We're going to start with introduction of committee measures. So I'll open a work session on introduction of committee measures. Representative Boone?
Chair Bailey, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC number 2873, dated February 7th, 2013. LC 3125, dated February 7th, 2013. LC 3128, dated January 28th, 2013. And LC 3358, dated February 7th, 2013.
Representative Boone moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 2873, LC 3125, LC 3128, and LC 3358. Is there a discussion? Objection? Motion carries. Close the work session on introduction of committee measures. And we're going to skip to the bottom and start there before we get into the presentations and open a work session on House Bill 2436. Adam?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2436 modifies the Energy Efficiency and Sustainable Technology, or EAST, loan program. It adds definitions of primary contractor and utility service territories, stipulates where the EAST loan funds may be spent, and who may administer the EAST loan funds. It removes the requirement of utilities on utilities to transfer EAST loan to any new property, to any new owner if the property is transferred. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Great. And we have our paperwork on that?
Yes.
Colleagues, as far as I know, this bill is ready to be worked. Any discussion? Is there a motion?
Chair Bailey, I move House Bill 2436 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2436 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Motion carries, and it's on its way to the floor. Representative Vega Peterson, would you be willing to carry?
Sure.
Okay. Representative Lightly has already preceded you.
I've got one tomorrow, so I'll be an old pro by the time.
All right. Sounds great. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2436 and open an informational meeting on Energy 101. And I'd like to call up to kick us off Lisa Schwartz and Jason Eisdorfer.
It's electric. Can't you feel it? This meets your computer right there.
Do we have the PowerPoint up?
Right there.
Okay. Sorry. Can only be in so many places at one time. Go first.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Schwartz, Oregon Department of Energy Director, and with me is...
Jason Eisdorfer, Utility Program Director of the Public Utility Commission.
And thank you for the opportunity today to present Energy 101 for Oregon. We're going to start with the big picture. First, let's look at energy use in total for the state across all sectors. You see in yellow, one-third of our energy use is in transportation. That's actually not going to be our focus today, although we'll give you a little bit of information on that. One-quarter of the energy in the state is in the residential sector. That's both electricity and heating. Similarly, one-quarter of the electricity use is in the industrial sector. And the remainder, about 19%, is in commercial businesses. Energy is a significant economic driver in Oregon, the U.S., and abroad. In Oregon alone, we spend about $6.5 billion every year on energy, not including transportation. And then the next several slides are going to focus in on the electricity sector. About 40% of the electricity consumed in the state is produced in state, and most of that is renewable resources, mainly hydropower. You can see in blue here on the chart. This is the period 2009-2011, so this is an average across the period for all of the electricity use in the state. About a third of the electricity came from coal-fired plants during this period. Natural gas was at 12%, and that amount is growing because of the low cost of natural gas in the foreseeable future as well. You can see utilities making a start toward meeting renewable portfolio standards, and nuclear power, primarily from the Columbia Generating Station, makes up most of the balance. There are two kinds of electric utilities. The first are the investor-owned or the privately held utilities. These are the ones that are regulated by the Oregon Public Utility Commission. We have three in the state of Oregon: Portland General Electric, PacifiCorp, and Idaho Power. And altogether, they represent about two-thirds of the electricity sales in our state and about three-quarters of the number of customers. Consumer-owned utilities are the other type of utilities in our state, and they are governed by their own boards of directors or city councils. We have three types. We have rural electric cooperatives, municipal utilities, and public utility districts. And altogether, they comprise about 29% of the electricity sales in the state. The legislature also has provided choice of supplier for all business customers of Pacific Power and Portland General Electric, and some have chosen to do so, and in this period of time in 2011, 2% of electricity sales were by these alternative suppliers. So how does electricity get from the power plant to your home? So regardless of the type of plants, a coal-fired plant, natural gas-fired plant, renewable resources, the first step is to step up the voltage so the electricity can travel efficiently along long distances over the transmission system. And we have three transmission interconnections in the United States: the Western Interconnection, which comprises all of the Western states and parts of Canada and a little bit of Mexico; the Eastern Interconnection, and there's one in Texas. And these really largely they're not connected. So while we can get power here in Oregon, say from Alberta, Canada, or Arizona, we're not getting it from Philadelphia. So the resource is traveling, the electricity is traveling along these high distance, high voltage lines, these transmission lines. As it gets closer to the points of delivery, it will be stepped down in voltage, travel across the distribution system, step down further in your neighborhoods on transformers to a voltage that works in your home.
So Lisa has introduced us generally to some of the overview concepts. Now we're going to take it down a step and start talking about some of the participants and dynamics. And we start actually at the regional level before we go down into the state level. Just like no man is an island, no utility exists only in one state. There are connections to the region, transmission, energy, and so there are a number of regional players that we wanted to introduce today. The biggest one is the Bonneville Power Administration. BPA is a power marketing administration arm of the United States Department of Energy. It markets the output of the federal dams on the Columbia River system system. There are 31 dams, and the output of the one nuclear operating plant in the Northwest in Washington, the Columbia Generating Station, and they also have a little bit of wind associated with it. And together, that makes up between about a quarter and a third of the total load of the Northwest. It depends. It is reliant very much on the water year, and that can vary significantly. Some years there's a lot of water, and some years there isn't. We'll talk a little bit, I think, at least we'll touch on energy storage later on when we talk about smart grid. And the Northwest is blessed with the biggest battery and the best battery you can imagine, not just the water behind the dams, but the water in the snowpack in the hills and the mountains, and as it comes down into the Columbia River, the value of that energy is quite significant. In addition, BPA owns and operates about three-quarters of the transmission system in the Northwest. They fund fish and wildlife mitigation projects to reduce the impacts on fish and wildlife, and they operate the core energy efficiency programs that, for the consumer-owned utilities. You may have heard that only, I think, 2 weeks ago, we have a new administrator, Bill Drummond, replacing Steve Wright, who had been administrator for, I think, over 10 years. So BPA provides power at cost. This is one of the points of differentiation between the investor-owned utilities and the consumer-owned utilities. The COUs have preference, according to federal statute, have preference to the output of BPA, so they get the lowest cost hydropower from BPA first. In 1980, the Northwest Power Act, some people, it's such an important act that some people in the electricity sector can refer to it as the 1980 Act. One of the things that it did was to create the residential exchange to allow residential and small farm customers of investor-owned utilities to have access to the benefits of BPA, not through direct sales, but through a bill credit. Another regional player is the Northwest Power Planning and Conservation Council, also a product of the 1980 Act. This is an interstate compact with two members from each of the Northwest states appointed by the governor of each of their states. There are really sort of two parts of the council. One is the council itself with the eight members, and they make some of those policy decisions. The other is a staff, which is made up of very smart folks. It is an asset that not every region of the country has. The two core things that they do, according to the Act, is to create a long-term regional plan to assure the Northwest an adequate, efficient, and economical supply of power. In a couple of minutes, we'll talk about an integrated resource plan, which is what the individual utilities put together. This is sort of like an IRP for the entire region. They look at the loads, they look at the risks that are out there, and they determine what the best set of resources the region as a whole could put together to serve that load in a least cost, least risk kind of way. It's not utility specific. It's very generic to the Northwest. The other thing that the council does is develops a plan to mitigate the effects of the dams on the, from the Columbia River system. So they put together a regional fish and wildlife program. BPA's resources must be developed consistent with the council's plan. There are exceptions to this, but that's the general rule. The power plan comes out every 5 years. The sixth power plan came out a couple of years ago, I think. It looks 20 years down the road. Again, this is the resource plan I was mentioning. It looks at the overall load that's needed on a regional basis. It looks at the various resources that could serve that load, looks at the risks, et cetera, and then it creates an action plan. So this is this is actually one of the council's, as soon as it loads, one of the council slides, and what this slide is trying to indicate is that almost all of the load growth over the next decade or so could be served with energy efficiency and renewable energy. That's the result of their plan. And then the third regional party we wanted to look at was the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. This is a regional nonprofit funded by BPA on behalf of the consumer-owned utilities, the Energy Trust of Oregon on behalf of Oregon investor-owned utilities, and then investor-owned utilities in other states. And the purpose of NEA is to invest in market transformation. This is transforming the energy efficiency markets. Things really as simple as going to the supply chain and making sure that efficient appliances are available. Market transformation is a regional effort. It's not a utility by utility effort, because you're, in order to transfer the market, you got to go big. And before I turn it back to Lisa, we're gonna switch back and forth so you don't get bored of either one of us. This is an example, a cross-section of some of the stakeholders that are out there. The Citizens Utility Board is a consumer organization in Oregon. There are consumer organizations in each of the states. CUB is ours, I suppose. Industrial Consumers of Northwest Utilities, an advocate of industrial customers. It's regional, similar with the gas users. The Renewable Northwest Project is an advocate for renewable energy in the Northwest. And Northwest Energy Efficiency Council, Stan Price was here last week, and various forms of labor. So this is a cross-section. There are plenty of other groups who like to participate in the energy issues.
A typical household in Oregon uses about 1,000 kilowatt hours of electricity each month. And costs in Oregon are lower than the national averages. For example, residential customers, their electricity costs are about 10 cents per kilowatt hour compared to the U.S. average of about 12 cents per kilowatt hour. And you can also see here that the costs for different types of customers are different based largely on the cost to serve them. Where we get our electricity really depends in large part, as you'll see in the next several slides, where a utility has access to the federal hydropower system. So starting with the investor-owned utilities, here are a couple pie charts, Pacific Power on the left, Portland General Electric on the right, and these are their resource mixes in the year 2010. So you can see Pacific Core's got two-thirds of its electricity mix from coal in this year. Natural gas comprised 16%, hydroelectric 10%, and other types of renewable resources besides hydro 8%. Portland General Electric on the right, its coal resource comprised 35% of its portfolio. Natural gas, about one quarter, hydroelectric, about 30%, and renewables beyond hydro, about 7%. And switching to the consumer-owned utilities that have access to the Bonneville hydro system, you can see the picture is quite different. All of the consumer-owned utilities together on the left, this is an aggregate across the 37 consumer-owned utilities. They're getting about three-quarters of their electricity in this year from hydro, 12% from nuclear, and that's from largely the Columbia Generating Station. Coal comprised about 7%, and there's very little natural gas in their portfolio. And looking just at one utility, this is the largest consumer-owned utility in our state, the Eugene Water and Electric Board. They also get a very large amount of their power from hydro. And overall, they own some additional facilities besides just getting their power from Bonneville. So their mix is a bit different, but still largely hydro. They rely a bit less on coal and have a bit more of renewable resources, for example, wind and solar, beyond just the hydro that they've got.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thanks. So how do you explain the differences? I mean, the consumer utilities, because they have first grab at the water, have that mainly, but the differences between PGE and Pacific Power, for example?
The differences between these two utilities? It's just a matter of the development of resources over time. So these are resources that each utility would independently invest in through the PUC regulatory process over a matter of decades. Actually, with PacifiCorp, they merged maybe 25 or 30 years ago already with the utility in Utah, and with that came a number of coal units. So it's just a matter of evolution on a utility-by-utility basis. And these are statistics from the PUC 2011 statistics book. This is a cross-section of rates of utilities in Oregon. There are a significant number more utilities, but it's a representative cross-section. You notice that the two large investor-owned utilities are on the higher end of the scale, there is a correlation. There are a number of things that go into what makes up a rate for a utility, but there is a correlation here between access to the output from the Bonneville Power Administration system, the federal system, and the rates of the COUs in particular. So let's spend a few minutes on the investor-owned utilities here. There are three electric IOUs in the state. Portland General Electric is the largest electric utility in the state. Its service territory is mostly in the North Willamette Valley, around Portland, a little bit around Salem. It's headquartered in Portland and it's publicly traded. PacifiCorp, also a significant size, but it is different in that it is spread throughout the state. It's much more diverse. In some parts quite rural. It's located in the southern Willamette Valley, a little bit on the coast, in the Bend area, and even in far eastern Oregon. Ultimately, it's owned by Berkshire Hathaway through the Mid-American Holding Company. And Idaho Power is the smallest footprint along the eastern edge of the state, and it's a publicly traded company. These are rates of the three IOUs over the last, how many years is that? 15, it looks like. You can see there's a steady incline in those rates. There's a lot of things that go into those rates, a lot of things that will explain sort of upwardly rising rates, new generating resources going into rate base, pollution control investments, distribution system investments, increase in power costs out on the market. Additional brake pressures will probably be caused in the near future by new transmission facilities coming online. The Dodd-Frank bill actually is creating some compliance issues and challenges for the investor-owned utilities. It was meant to be mostly tracking financial instruments, but energy swaps got swept up in some of that. Don't know for sure, but the trajectory looks like it may keep going for a while. And this is a sort of a simple slide just to create in your mind the difference between supply side and demand side. We talked, I think, a little bit last Tuesday about supply side. It's anything that's going to generate a kilowatt hour, from nuclear to gas to coal to solar and wind. Demand side is in my house. It's in my insulation, in my windows. It's the kinds of programs that energy efficiency can capture, some of those captured, acquired conservation kilowatt hours, and demand response, which is sort of a responsive reduction in load according to a signal from the utility. So here's the IRP, here's the Integrated Resource Plan. For the IOUs, the Public Utility Commission requires each IOU, actually this is both electric and gas, every 2 years to file an Integrated Resource Plan. The core of the plan is to examine the load that is out there right now per utility. Each utility will do this independently, and extrapolate that load growth over 20 years, and then determine what the best combination of resources would be to meet the needs of that load in the least cost, least risk kind of way. Along the way, the IRP looks at risks and uncertainties like fossil fuel cost volatility, climate change regulation, pollution control policies, EPA regulations, those kinds of things. It's an intensive process. Stakeholders are invited to come to the table. There's significant numbers of thought and input goes into trying to create these scenarios from which the IRP ultimately picks the best set of resources to serve load. Okay, so next two slides are going to test the adage that a picture is worth a thousand words. We put these in, and I think ultimately they're pretty intuitive. This is an example of Portland General Electric. This is something that would be looked at in an IRP. We'll start with the red line. The red line angling upwards is the assumed load over time. The layer cake, those are layers of existing resources that PGE has. You can see some continuing out into the future. There are a couple here as an example that terminate. The one at the very top in the light blue is long-term contracts. There are a series of contracts that PGE has for the output from hydro resources that are on the Columbia system but are non-federal, and they are going to expire. On the bottom is the Boardman coal plant, slated to retire in 2020. So the idea in an IRP is to try to figure out exactly how to fill that growing need. One utility need not fill the entire, you don't need to fill it up to the top. You can still go out to the market and buy from the market. But part of the IRP process is to determine what kind of risk do you have by, depending upon where you are in that resource stack, how close do you get to serving that load.
I would imagine, too, that one can either build up the resource stack or bring that red line down.
So let's go back there a second. That's an excellent point. So energy efficiency, for example, you can actually look at energy efficiency two different ways. You can look at energy efficiency essentially bringing that red line down and closing the gap that way. Another way you can look at it is as energy efficiency as a resource, so it would become another layer on top. Either way, you get to the same place, which is you're closing the gap between your resource need and your resources.
Sorry, one more question.
Go ahead.
Question. Go ahead.
I would guess that red line also is dependent upon economic growth. What kind of assumptions are built in? Obviously, a depressed economy brings that red line down, too.
So with all due respect to the prognosticators at PGE, they are always wrong about the load. It's hard to predict the Great Recession of 2008 when you're doing this in 2006, but that's exactly right.
That's a great point. And you may get into this, but the filling that gap through market purchases, I would imagine, is a more expensive option. Is that correct?
It depends upon what the market is going to look like. So that's another one of those assumptions and another one of those uncertainties. PGE, for example, was deficient, I suppose, in the late 90s, and market prices were very, very low. So they did very well by that. When market prices skyrocketed in the year 2000 during the energy crisis, they were quite exposed. And so that's exactly one of those unknowns that you run through, that you model through one of these scenarios to determine what the optimal exposure to the market might be.
Great.
Okay, so here's another one of the tests of the adage. I included this one actually for Representative Bentz on the question that he had on Tuesday. We'll make sure that he gets this.
School.
So this is resource curve that is trying to indicate what the stack of lowest cost to sort of higher cost resources and the size of the resource. And so this is, for example, only this is a slide from the Power Council. And it's a couple of years old, and I think arguably gas prices have come down sufficiently, so some of these resources may change, but it would not change the core point of the slide, which is that the first set of resources that are the cheapest are going to be conservation. The council uses the word conservation to include energy efficiency, and so you go up that cost curve, and then you have sort of a battle for between certain renewables, gas plant, etc. Notice, I would say also that there are energy efficiency resources on the far right that can be very expensive. So it really depends upon the overall cost in the particular program that you're talking about. And so here, I think, is where the utility is going to look and see what is the least cost way of stacking those resources, and this resource curve is one way to do that.
So this is probably easier to look at, although it might not be quite as interesting. This is fairly new information, July 2012, from the U.S. Energy Information Administration. And it shows if you were to put a power plant in service in the year 2017, what would it cost? So what's really notable about this slide is the change in two resources in particular. Natural gas prices have come way down. So the all-in cost of a natural gas plant, according to the EIA, is sitting at 6.6 cents a kilowatt hour. So that's why you're seeing a lot of power plants owned by utilities or in the marketplace that are going to natural gas. Another notable feature about this slide is the solar costs have come down tremendously. And in this case, this is the utility scale grid connected solar down to 15 cents per kilowatt hour. This is quite the change in the last few years. We have here also conventional coal prices at 9.8 cents. So you could see it's not stacking up quite as good on a straight up cost basis with natural gas. And then looking toward clean coal, the integrated gasification combined cycle plant, for example, a little bit older data from the Northwest Power and Conservation Council's 6 power plant showed that at about 14 cents. So these are some of the choices as utilities are looking in their integrated resource planning processes to see when they have a need to fill beyond what they'll do with energy efficiency, what they're looking at. And of course, they're looking at all these other risks as well, reserving a portion of the portfolio for market purchases, especially because the lows are uncertain. Also, just having a mix of resources and, of course, meeting any kinds of compliance requirements that they have.
Representative
Whitson? Yes, I was wondering if your solar, wind, or alternative energy, if the costs there include subsidies from the federal government in those, or those actually the cost without subsidized from the state or federal government.
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, my understanding is these are the actual straight-up costs without any subsidies, but I'll ask my folks in the back to jot down your question and get back to you, make sure that we're correct here. Thank you.
Good question. Thanks. Representative Vega Peterson.
Yeah, and it's my understanding that the price of natural gas has gone down mostly because of hydraulic fracturing in the last few years. Is it?
Chair Bailey, Representative Vega Peterson, I think that along with just finding additional supplies, but I am not a natural gas expert, and apparently neither is Jason.
And we will have some natural gas experts coming up a little bit later, so we'll get to that question.
Okay, thanks.
We also want to present to you some of the emissions information on these same sources of power. So these are actual emissions data for our region, the Northwest Power Pool, and these are averages in the data year 2009, recently available from the federal government. So I think a couple of takeaways from this slide. One is that natural gas-fired plants have about half of the carbon emissions and significantly fewer sulfur dioxide emissions compared to coal-fired plants. I think another takeaway is, of course, renewable resources, hydro, wind, and solar have no emissions And so this, of course, is also a consideration as utilities are looking to fill their resource needs and also trying to predict what kinds of emissions controls they might be facing in the future that would actually be reflected in cost to consumers in their utility bills.
Sorry, basic question. What is other fossil beyond oil, gas, and coal?
Chair Bailey, that's an excellent question. I actually will ask my staff to get back and make sure, too. My assumption is that something like pet coal, petroleum, but I'm not positive. I have the exact same question.
Okay. Thank you.
Maybe. Propane, maybe?
Perhaps, yeah. Thank you.
So in the interest of reusing and recycling, this is a slide that you saw last week. This is simply introducing the topic specifically of energy efficiency. The theme of energy efficiency, cost effective energy efficiency is the cheapest resource, at least upfront. So the Energy Trust of Oregon is the energy efficiency acquisition agent for four investor-owned utilities in the state. Portland General Electric, Pacific Corp, Northwest Natural, and Cascade. The ETO works with each of these utilities in their IRPs to determine what that level of cost-effective energy efficiency is, the optimal level that the utility should be investing in, and it's the Energy Trust that then goes out and acquires that energy efficiency. The Public Utility Commission has direct oversight of the Energy Trust. There's layers and layers of oversight. In fact, Commissioner Savage sits as an ex officio on the board. There are yearly performance measures. There's a grant agreement with the Public Utility Commission that determines what the Energy Trust obligations are. Quarterly and annual reports, the PUC gets to weigh in on the Energy Trust budget and their programs. There are several different kinds of audits that the Energy Trust undergoes, and we have regular management meetings with them to talk about what the next issue is going to be. So we made a choice here. We, rather than showing you both, we could have shown you either the annual Energy Trust energy efficiency acquisitions on this is electric side, or the cumulative one. The cumulative one is sort of angled straight up. The reason I think we chose to show you the year by year is twofold. Number one, I think to Representative Johnson's point, you notice that there is a dip between 2008-2009. That's sort of the heart of the recession. I think, as I said last week, while cost-effective energy efficiency is inherently good, sometimes it's pretty hard, and you've got to get into people's businesses and people's homes. And when people are feeling their disposable income is not quite disposable, there's a challenge. Significantly, however, the jump between 2009 and 2010 and sort of staying up there is really a testament to the delivery mechanism that the Energy Trust uses. The other reason, I think, is, and I know the Energy Trust is coming up after us, and this might be a point to have a conversation with them, the early numbers look like the electricity energy efficiency acquisition for 2012 is going to be over 50 average megawatts, which is I think outstanding, if not stunning. You can see where on an annual basis they began when the electric utilities ran these programs. It's a little hard to tell sometimes exactly on an annual basis what they were acquiring, but they were significantly below these kinds of numbers. So we turn to natural gas for a couple of minutes. The three natural gas utilities in Oregon are Northwest Natural, Avista, and Cascade. The Northwest Natural Service Territory is Western Oregon, headquartered in Portland. Avista is largely in Southwest Oregon, Roseburg in Klamath Falls, and a little bit in Northeast around La Grande. Its headquarters is in Spokane. And then Cascade, and Avista is also part in Washington State, Avista is both the natural gas and the electric utility. In Oregon, it's just natural gas. And Cascade is largely in Central Oregon, and it's a part of MDU Resources out of the Dakotas. The natural gas utilities are different than the electric utilities. These basically, they're local distribution companies. They don't get involved in exploration and recovery of gas. They're really buying gas on the market and delivering it through to customers. So those are the utilities that are the Public Utility Commission regulates. We put the gas transmission pipelines on here just to show you that there are those entities, those are interstate pipeline companies, are not regulated by the Public Utility Commission. One bit of flexibility that a natural gas delivery company could have is storage. Northwest Natural has developed Mist. In the St. Helens area, Avista has Jackson Prairie storage, which are really, these are really geological formations into which you can pump natural gas and use it. It allows you to arbitrage when the prices of gas are higher or lower. You can take some out and sell it or buy it when it's low and put it in. It's a significant benefit to customers. Northwest Natural also is relatively unique in that it does have some experience with LNG, liquefied natural gas facilities. In truth, the LNG facilities for storage are dwarfed by the kinds of storage that the geological storage. We're talking about billions of cubic feet in Mist, and the LNG is really just a small percentage of that. This is the natural gas rates. Again, you can see there are pressures here that increase rates. Some of the pressures here are really the commodity costs, but also investment in customer information systems and distribution facilities and that kind of stuff. And here, too, is the results of acquisition in terms of therms for the natural gas utilities acquired by the Energy Trust. And actually, you can see a relatively similar kind of pattern where 2008, 2009, there were some struggles, and then post that, significant gains. The Public Utility Commission also, in its Safety, Reliability, and Security Division at the PUC were responsible for enforcing the safe operation of intrastate natural gas pipelines. Probably the most important part of their task is to make sure that the utility pipeline crews are well-trained and keep appropriate records. They inspect, they review these records, they respond to incidents to determine what the root cause was. So that's an important part of the commission staff that sometimes gets forgotten. And the Oregon Utility Notification Center, this is the Call Before You Dig program. You dial 811 before you start digging around your property. It'll tell you what any underground utility is there. Once this program got started, the number of accidents and incidents has declined significantly.
We're going to switch to some emerging issues, although we've been long into the renewable portfolio standards since 2011. 2013. In 2007, the legislature passed the renewable portfolio standard for the state with an aim to stimulate the development of new renewable resources. So that meant that renewable energy facilities developed before the year in statute, before 1995, of any sort, including hydro, are not eligible because the point was to develop new resources over and above what we already had, and the percentages were set based on that. At the same time, we and my department have seen a number of efficiency upgrades to hydro facilities come through and be certified for the program, and an unlimited amount of those hydro efficiency upgrades are allowed under statute. as well as low-impact hydro up to statutory limits. Virtually all kinds of renewable resources are allowed under the law, wind and solar and biomass and geothermal among them. My department has limited statutory authorities. They include, first and foremost, the certification of systems that are eligible under the Oregon Renewable Portfolio Standard, because each state can only have one administrator that ensures that the renewable energy credits, whether they're for a mandatory program like a renewable portfolio standard or a voluntary customer program like green power programs, that those renewable energy credits are used once and only once throughout the entire western U.S. And so the system that tracks that as part of the Western Electricity Coordinating Council requires that only one state entity serve as the program administrator for all. And in this state, that happens to be the Oregon Department of Energy. So far, we have already certified at my department 218 generators as Oregon RPS eligible for that system in the western U.S. So my department, that's our primary role on the compliance side. For the investor and utilities, that's the Oregon Public Utility Commission. And for the consumer-owned utilities, again, they are self-regulating, they're self-governing. That's up to their boards of governors and their city councils to ensure compliance. So one slide on smart grid seems almost absurd, but we'll give it a try just to introduce the topic. Smart grid means a lot of different things to different people. Here's how I like to look at it. Broadly, it's an interconnected system of information and communication technologies that works together with all of the technologies throughout the electric system, from power plants to transmission to distribution system, all the way down to people's homes, to potentially do some really good things. First, can help customers manage energy use and reduce utility bills. Second, and very important, it has the potential to increase system reliability through automation, taking out a lot of the manual processes we have today where system operators are trying to manage to avoid reliability issues and to keep the power running. And finally, it has the potential to improve integration of wind and solar, in part through measures like demand response, where consumers and businesses can have automation in place to have their demands moderated automatically. For example, when prices are high in the marketplace, but also when wind, for example, is blowing rather strongly in the Columbia Gorge and prices are low, they can take advantage of that potentially and have a better integration of the system. And things as simple as running electric water heaters in an automated process in conjunction with the utility have tremendous potential here to reduce consumer costs. And so part of the smart grid is in the utility-based system, in their distribution systems, for example. But part of it is clearly in homes and businesses where consumers may wish to have plug-in hybrid vehicles in the future, where they we hope to be able to see less expensive forms of electricity storage beyond our blessings for hydro. That would be really helpful with prices coming down. So smart grid allows a way to be able to integrate all of these new technologies in the electric system with the existing technology, hopefully to reduce costs and maintain and hopefully enhance reliability. Here's besides the electric vehicles we really showed in that last slide, which is a subject in and of itself, here's just one slide on transportation as well, on compressed natural gas in this case, just to make you aware that there are 13 so far compressed natural gas fueling stations along the I-5 corridor, as well as one in Cave Falls. Two of them are accessible to the public, and the primary driver really is reduced costs and reduced emissions.
Lisa, when you look at compressed natural gas, is propane one of those options as well, too, and does your department track that?
My department, Chair Bailey, my department does track propane. We're agnostic, really. We're looking at all of the alternative transportation fuels. So compressed natural gas, liquefied natural gas, they're appropriate in different situations, propane as well as biofuels and electricity.
So we, in the the presentation with some promotional materials. The PUC mission is there for you to read. The PUC does not receive money from the general fund, but from a charge on customer bills. I think we've gone through this, that there are three electric utilities and three natural gas utilities. In addition, the PUC also regulates certain telecom utilities and water utilities. So the PUC, the core PUC responsibility, just setting the rates for residents and businesses in the state. In enforcing price and service rules, the IRP there is really the third bullet, looking to make sure that the utility finds the range of resources to serve customers at lowest cost and risk. Our consumer complaint division takes complaints from IOU utility customers. When there's a wide variety of transactions occur in front of the commission, including mergers. I think there have been 7 or 8 filed merger attempts in Oregon, I think in the last 15 years, on both the electricity and the telecom side. We oversee the Energy Trust of Oregon, and we're looking really looking harder and more vigorously at the seismic preparedness plans of the utilities.
In relationship to generation facilities?
Just about everything. Looking at both telecom and energy are core to societies, we know it, and when the big one comes, we're looking at the kind of impact that may have and trying to prioritize the kinds of hardening that the utilities will undertake.
The mission of the Oregon Department of Energy is to reduce the long-term costs of energy for Oregonians, and we think long-term. We think of the economic costs, the environmental costs, public health costs, and other social costs. We said at the top of the slides that Oregonians spend $6.5 billion a year in energy, excluding transportation. When we include the transportation bill, we're up to $13 billion a year on energy, and nearly all of that money leaves the state. We can reduce that cost by focusing first and foremost on cost-effective energy efficiency and also take a look at Oregon's own energy resources. My department is supported by federal funds, fees for service, and an energy supplier assessment. And more than two-thirds of our funding comes from non-limited sources, treasury bonds, to support the small-scale energy loan program. We were created in 1975, and here's what the legislature said in creating the department. The continued growth in demand for non-renewable energy forms poses a serious problem. It is essential that future generations not be left with a legacy of vanished or depleted resources, resulting in massive environmental, social, and financial impact. It is the goal of Oregon to promote the efficient use of energy resources and to develop permanently sustainable energy resources. The need exists for comprehensive state leadership in energy production, distribution, and utilization. And our enabling statute spells out a number of department roles, including siting of major energy facilities, collecting and analyzing energy data, educating the public about ways to save energy, and protecting Oregon from radioactive material at Hanford. And here really are our core goals: to maximize the acquisition of cost-effective energy efficiency. We are the state's lead agency on schools and government buildings, providing information and technical and financial assistance as well for residents and businesses. We help look out and develop the infrastructure that we will need in the future for clean energy resources, protecting Oregon from contamination at Hanford. And we have a strong role, as well as the PUC, in ensuring state preparedness for emergencies. We are the lead agency for emergencies, for preparing in an event of an emergency, for coordinating emergencies at energy facilities of all kinds, during transportation of radioactive materials throughout the state. And in the event of a petroleum shortage, it's our responsibility to ensure that emergency personnel have the oil that they need, the petroleum they need to do their jobs. We also conduct objective planning, policy, and technical analysis on a statewide basis to prepare for future electric, thermal, and transportation energy needs. And among our goals is excellent customer service. We have quite the workload today in energy facility siting. Our department is staff to the Oregon Energy Facility Siting Council, which is a 7-member volunteer board appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. The council evaluates proposals for energy facilities based on a set of standards, and it's a proactive approach. If a facility meets the standards, it gets a site certificate, and any appeal of that goes directly to the Oregon Supreme Court. So here's our current workload to give you a sense. We're reviewing 2 major transmission lines, Cascade Crossing for Portland General Electric and Boardman to Hemingway for Idaho Power, 4,000 megawatts of wind projects, 1,400 megawatts of natural gas-fired power plants, 1 biomass facility, and amendments for 8 facilities that already have site certificates. And I'll close here with some of the accomplishments so you get a feel for some of the work that we have done to date. We've got $11 million in savings per year for energy measures installed in new and remodeled state buildings as a result of our state energy efficient design program. We've performed energy audits for over 1,600 schools, so far resulting in $6.3 million in savings every year. We've certified 134 industrial facilities under the Senate Bill 1149 Energy Efficiency Program, where industrial customers can direct public purpose funds to their own projects on site to save energy. We've helped increase infrastructure for electric vehicle fueling by 1,800% in the last 2 years. We now have something like 300 locations where consumers can recharge their electric vehicles. We pursued a very strong role for the state of Oregon at the Hanford site and recently convinced the U.S. Department of Energy to begin treating contaminated groundwater to keep it from reaching the Columbia River and Oregon. 19 hospitals, schools, and offices have converted to biomass for heating, saving up to $100,000 at each of these facilities per year. We recently completed administering $52 million in Federal Recovery Act funds that supported 272 projects around the state to save energy to the tune of $8 million annually. And our legacy tax credit program for businesses helped fund nearly 25,000 energy-saving and renewable energy projects in the state, totaling some $3.1 billion in investment by businesses here, with cumulative savings or generation from renewable resources equal to the annual energy use of more than 1 million households.
Representative Whitson.
I just have a question. If you have an estimation of how many electric vehicles are presently on the road in Oregon, and what was the cost of the 300 locations to recharge the vehicles?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsett, I'll be happy to get back to you with that information.
Okay.
Actually, Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
Do you have that for... Well, at least myself and maybe the rest of the committee as well.
Yeah, for all the questions that have come from the dais, it would be great if you could just prepare answers for the committee and then everybody can see the answers to each of the questions that's been asked.
That'd be great. Sure, Bill, I would be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Are we going to do questions now?
Are you finished with your presentation?
Chair Bailey, I just wanted to encourage you all to contact myself or Jason if you have any questions about anything we presented today or you have questions from your constituents on an energy issue, we're here to help. Thank you.
Thank you both for the presentation. It was very thorough and very interesting, and I'm sure we'll look forward to diving into it. We'll take questions from the committee for this panel, and just so we're clear on the framing, after this we'll have a panel from the investor-owned utilities, followed by a panel from the consumer-owned utilities, followed by a panel from consumer groups, so there may be some answers to your questions there as well. Representative Boone.
I have about 3, I think, and all but one go to both of you, and that one would go to Lisa. So, first, I'd like to thank you both for the efforts that you have put forth for the resiliency plan, which was unfortunately prematurely leaked as a draft, but it will come to our legislature I think the deadline is February 28th. So it'll come to Emergency Prep and Veterans Committee first. And then a media rollout on the 11th of March. I have a couple questions for you. You said between 2007 and 2013, so 6 years, 218 projects have been, connected to the RPS. And I'm guessing some of them are retrofits to old hydro but new pieces. And I guess my question is on that, do you think with that number of projects in that short a time, do you think if we counted all hydro as renewable, we would see a drop in these, new hydro and innovative hydro on the old stuff to not counting new hydro? I know this is getting confusing, but I expect you to follow me here. let me start over. If we didn't have that, do you think that we would see a drop in innovative new stuff or continuation or what or more?
Chair Bailey, Representative Boone, if we didn't may I ask for clarification of the question? If we didn't have the hydro efficiency upgrades eligible for the RPS?
Representative Boone, is your question if we allowed retroactively older hydro facilities into the RPS, would we see upgrades in efficiency on hydro projects that do qualify for the RPS? Yeah. I guess it's the hypothetical. Is that right?
Yeah.
Chair Bailey.
All these 218 are hydro. I know that.
Chair Bailey, Representative Boone, if we allowed existing hydro to qualify, that is hydro, that existed prior to 1995, as the current law prohibits counting toward the standard. I think if you saw any additional older resources allowed, you would see fewer efficiency improvements unless they were cost effective in and of their own, because the utilities and the investor-owned utilities are looking to prudently meet their compliance obligations under the renewable portfolio standard. And so they wouldn't be acquiring additional renewable resources unless they were the least cost, least risk resource. Having said that, prior to passage of the renewable portfolio standard, we did see some development of renewables, but we certainly see accelerated development of renewable resources under the standard that we have today, which is looking to develop just new sources and not rely on old ones. So I agree that I think you would see fewer efficiency upgrades at hydro facilities, but the utilities may also want to comment on that.
Also, I didn't hear anything about storage and battery storage or anything like that, and wondered what you know. I mean, I know it's out there. I know that there's a lot of activity in that. I just wondered if you have considered that or are working on it or involved in it or what.
Chair Bailey, Representative Boone, a lot of people are thinking about this. The Power Planning Council had a work group, a think tank, that worked on it for a year, and they have some really cool charts and graphs about their different kinds of technologies and storage. I think that those innovations are still trying to find the right price points. It's hard to say at this point that storage is cost effective, the kind of thing that would find its way easily into an IRP. Clearly those values are becoming increasingly clear as more intermittent variable energy resources come online and require sort of quick response to integrate. I think those storage facilities are going to find a place. I think at this point the cost of them is still an issue.
Thank you.
My last question.
Sure.
And it's probably for, I don't know, you both address it. It's about the ESA, and I just wondered, is it dedicated to a certain use? Is it limited, or is it just in the mix and you can use it for whatever you like?
Chair Bailey, Representative Boone, by ESA, I assume you're referring to the energy supplier assessment, which provides some portions of the funding for Oregon Department of Energy. Those uses are specified by statute. We'll be presenting to Ways and Means on Monday and Tuesday next week, and among our supplemental materials, you'll find the authorities that we have under the law, but we also will have some information additionally on energy supplier assessment. But those uses are specified by statute.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Reed.
Well, I wasn't going to ask this question, but I'd like to follow up on Representative Boone's question. The ESA projects, who participates in the definition of the projects?
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon, the funding that's specified under statute for energy supplier assessment is for certain uses, not specified for an individual project. If by project you mean, say, for example, an energy facility or that type of thing.
Energy savings program or whatever.
Those tend to be more operating funds for the department for specific uses. Is that correct, as opposed to project implementation?
Chair Bailey, that's correct. These are specified under the law uses that for the types of work that we may perform using those funds, as opposed to project specific uses.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you have another question, Representative, that you were going to ask?
I'm watching the clock, so I think I'll hold off. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for a very informative presentation. I've learned a lot. Ms. Schwartz, when you made the point that Oregonians spend more than $13 billion a year on energy and nearly all of that money leaves the state, how do you define nearly all that money? I mean, there are some things that stay in the state, right? I mean, if you're talking about transmission, the electricians who are working on, doing that work, or the people who are working on the wind generating facilities, and, solar, to the extent that we're producing wafers here in Oregon. How do you sort of analyze that and assess that? I'm sympathetic to the general notion, but just in terms of the specifics.
Chair Bailey, Representative Denbrough, that's primarily referring to the commodity portion. So we don't have the blessing of having, native gas supplies here, native coal supplies. We are very fortunate to have hydroelectric resources, and so that's part of the equation of the money that is staying in state. We do have very good wind resources. We've got some decent solar resources and geothermal and so forth. But the preponderance of our energy consumption today, as you saw on much of those charts, a lot of it is coal use, which is out of state, generated out of state, coming by wire, although Boardman is in our state. So it's really a preponderance on the commodity side. You're right that to the extent that that's paying for the distribution system and the transmission system and so forth, that's embedded in Oregon. That is money that is in the state.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentations. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Bailey. Thank you, members of the committee.
Okay, we have a number of panels to get through, and being mindful of the time, I'm very appreciative to presenters that are coming up, but if you could make sure to keep your remarks concise, that would be wonderful. Thank you. I'd like to call up Mary Haynes, Gary Bauer, and Scott Bolton. Colleagues, you'll note that under the panel investor-owned utilities, that we have left out a couple of presenters from investor-owned utilities in this state. We made the decision to focus, for the sake of time, on those utilities that cover the bulk of the customers in Oregon. So, but not trying to disparage Idaho Power or Vista or other companies in any way. We're very thankful for the service that they provide to this state, but we thought we would proceed with these three. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes, and I represent Portland General Electric. I do have some slides that hopefully are coming up, but I'll go ahead and just start talking. PGE is the largest investor-owned electric utility in the state. We operate in about a 4,000 square mile area, largely in the northern Willamette Valley. We serve about 825,000 customers. It's about 43% of the electricity consumers statewide. We encapsulate about 52 cities and have close to 2,800 megawatts of generation in our system. I think it's also worth noting that within our service territory is about 70% of the state's GDP. So,
Ms. Haynes, I'm going to pause you for 1 second. I apologize for the distraction that's going on around you. I believe I saw a PGE Energy 101 PowerPoint on the desktop.
Okay, so we're done with the first slide. This should look somewhat similar to what you saw in the last presentation. I think the difference here is that we have included the top wedge there is action plan acquisitions. I'll be talking about that a little bit later, but that gap that was identified in the prior presentation, we're working right now and have a number of RFPs out to fill that gap. So you can see where we come up over the line. And then, again, you'll see where we have some resources falling off, notably in about 2017. We're losing some mid-sea contracts. Those are long-term hydro contracts that we've had that will be rolling off of our system. We'll have to replace that energy. And you can also see the larger slant down in 2020, and that's with the cessation of burning coal at our Boardman plant. I would also add one other thing based on the last conversation, that load forecast line, the red line that you see there, when we're looking at our IRP, the way that we adjust for energy efficiency is to bring that line down. So we essentially view energy efficiency as reducing the load that we have to meet with other types of generating resources, whether those are supply side or demand side resources. The next slide is worth taking a look at. When we are looking to fill our portfolio, we're looking at a balanced approach. We have both intermittent resources, renewables, largely wind in our system, and it's also important for us to match some of those with dispatchable resources, which at this point are primarily gas and hydro, gas becoming the larger part of that in the future. What's worthy of noting and why that's important to the system and ensuring the reliability is that the top yellow line you can see are the peak load on the system. This is during a particularly hot day in July when the wind isn't blowing quite as heavy in the gorge. So you see those peak system loads, and then if you can see the little red dots toward the bottom, that's actually the output of Bigelow Wind Farm, which is our 450 megawatt wind project out in the gorge. So making sure that you have a diversified portfolio, that you've got some of the gas and hydro and other dispatchable resources there to help balance that load is important and will continue to be important as we add more of these types of renewables onto the system. So our IRP action plan, what's filling that top wedge of the slide I showed you a couple previous, we have a number of RFPs out right now, RFPs out for capacity. The year-round flexible resource, PGE, has won that RFP, but we're continuing to work on RFPs for peaker facilities, for baseload energy resources, and also additional renewables to meet our 2015 RPS compliance date. Right now, we're planning on filling our compliance targets with physical resources and not using bank directs at this point. We also, in our action plan, are working hard on Cascade Crossing. It would be a new transmission line from Boardman, which now we've adjusted the scope of the project slightly. It was supposed to come into Salem. That's we're now looking at a shorter project that we're working with BPA on. We've recently signed an MOU to continue conversations on how we might partner on that project. We also have some demand-side resources. We work with the ETO in our IRP to identify cost-effective energy efficiency that we fund, and the ETO goes out and gets. We've also got some additional demand-side resources, and we're beginning to work to implement Boardman 2020. That includes, right now, installing some additional pollution controls, and then, again, we'll be looking in the future toward what we're going to be replacing that resource with when we stop burning coal in 2020. This is the current and projected energy portfolio mix. I won't spend too much time on this, but you can see how some of those numbers are adjusting. Gas is becoming a larger portion of that wedge. Coal diminishes quite a bit, and renewables are growing along with the compliance targets. Some of the more innovative things that we're doing, looking to the future, smart meters. We have installed smart meters throughout our entire system. It provides both utility side benefits and consumer benefits. We have an energy tracker program that if you're a PG customer, you can go online right now and help better understand your energy use and ways that you can manage that and help control the costs. On the utility side, transportation and distribution benefits are significant. We can better respond to outages and predict where we've got problems on the system. The Salem Smart Power Project, we are working with some battery storage in this project. It's part of a much larger effort with the national labs. We're just getting this underway. You know, batteries do provide a lot of potential, but it's pretty nascent technology still, and so we'll be getting a lot more information back on that. That project also looks at islanding certain territories so that they become essentially self-healing in the event of some kind of outage or problem in the system. Boardman Biomass is a significant R&D project that we have underway. We're looking at a variety of feedstocks that we could torrefy, essentially suck the water out of those materials and use those, essentially burn them as we would have with coal in the Boardman facility. We're looking at 2014 for a test burn, and we're exploring lots of different demand response kind of programs, and solar. We've just signed to bring on one of the largest utility scale solar projects in the state of Oregon at 5 megawatts in eastern Oregon. So I will leave it at that and turn it over to the others.
Thank you.
Marian, as you guys scale back your coal percentage of your portfolio, what's the impact on your ratepayers over that 8-year period? I think you had about 2021 versus 2013.
Yeah, the Boardman 2020 plan came as a result of some federal regulatory requirements that PG would have had to meet around regional haze and BART, the best available retrofit technology. So the situation that we were looking at was making a significant investment in pollution controls, I think in the order of $500 million or so, and continuing to operate the plant. But we would have undertaken a significant amount of cost that would have flowed through to our customers to install all of those controls. And what we were able to do is find a compromise whereby we got permission from both state and federal agencies to install a lesser amount of pollution controls for a shorter amount of time in exchange for stopping burning coal sooner than we otherwise would have in 2020. And our analysis showed that based on all of those different inputs, it was actually the right choice for our customers. It was a lower choice than putting on the extensive controls and continuing to run the plant into the future.
Yes, Representative Peters.
I just have a question. Do you know which feedstock varieties you guys are testing out in the for the Boardman Biomass project?
One that we have had, that we have been directly involved in growing and testing, is Arundo Donax. Mm-hmm. We have three farms that we're working on, and a lot of input with the state and the Department of Agriculture and other groups in the way that we're approaching that. We're also looking at all sorts of different, I could rattle off 20 different types of things that we're looking at. I don't know them all off the top of my head, but we're very open right now as to what we may use in the future.
Just about anything you can make a briquette out of.
Right.
I recommend Kingsbird. Yeah. Mr. Bolton. Great.
Quick question.
Sorry,
Representative Reed. Would you recalibrate me, please? What can I do with 5 megawatts? What can I run? Because I just don't think about it every day. So is that a house or 10?
Ooh.
That's a really big house. You got a nice house.
I know.
You know, that's a good question. I don't know the answer.
Mr. Chairman, that would probably be a couple thousand homes.
A couple thousand? Yeah. Okay. Just thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. Pacific Corp is a regional utility serving 1.7 million customers across 6 western states. In Oregon, the company operates as Pacific Power, and we have about 550,000 retail electric customers. We're Oregon's largest rural power provider, serving communities along the coast, southern Oregon, the Willamette Valley, central Oregon, northeastern Oregon, and virtually all points in between. We have customers or assets in 31 of the state's 36 counties. And we were born actually in the communities of Astoria and Pendleton, have been serving those communities for over 100 years. Unlike our larger utility friends, we did it old school and passed out packets. So what I'd like to do is just orient you to the map that's located inside there, and that'll probably help you follow along with pretty much anything I've got to present today. We have a large generation portfolio, over 10,000 megawatts of capacity. That's frankly reflective of the energy mix across the states across the western states that we serve. We have large hydro assets in the Pacific Northwest, coal and gas generation in the Rocky Mountain states, and a large wind portfolio that we've accumulated over the last few years. The company now has more than 1,700 megawatts of owned and contracted wind generation as of the end of last year. And at the end of last year, we also commissioned our first utility-scale solar project, a 2-megawatt solar project in Lakeview, Oregon. We're about to release a request for proposal for additional solar resources probably by the end of the month. Pacific Corp is also the largest private owner of high voltage transmission across the western U.S. We're underway on a number of major transmission expansion projects and are also supportive of other transmission development that's happening in our region. And frankly, not only is transmission investment critical for our company, it's really becoming much needed infrastructure when you consider the need to begin integrating and reaching new renewable resources. Transmission is a key component to being able to meet federal policies and federal policies around reliability as well as state policies around encouraging new renewables. Rather than getting too much into company history, because I know our time is short, what I'd like to do is maybe highlight three major areas that we find challenging and will certainly color our perspectives on policies that we'll be confronted with during the legislative session. First is just simply the slow recovery in the rural economy in Oregon. It's no secret to communities that we serve that they are still continuing to struggle in the wake of the recession. As their local utility, we've seen this effect in the loss of loads. Pacific Power has experienced 5 straight years of load decline in Oregon. And in our industrial customer sector, we've seen a load loss of over 20%. So that's substantial. That is not just a downturn in the economy. That is real lost capacity in certain sectors, in particular the forest product sector. Right now, as we look at our business plan and our integrated resource plans, we do not expect to see pre-recession, so 2007 level loads, until 2023. So we do think that we're going to be that flat is the new normal and that we will see very incremental load growth at best. This fact, coupled with the capital investment needs of the system and the fact that that investment outpaces depreciation in our system right now, does mean that our fixed costs are going up. So our customers are experiencing rate increases as a result of this dynamic. What the company's tried to do is we undertook a major initiative in 2012 to better align our cost structure with our customers' ability to pay. So what that meant is we took a number of large capital projects out of our capital planning budget, or we deferred out those projects a number of years, as well as we've looked to squeeze expense out of our business as much as we can, to the extent that we've eliminated several hundred positions out of the company overall. The bottom line is that we understand the experiences and the economic hardship that our customers, particularly in rural Oregon, have been experiencing. We want to make sure that we're responsive to that and that we're designing a business and a system to serve them that is affordable as well as reliable and safe. Another challenge has been to further integrate renewable energy and strengthen the reliability of the grid. Again, we are a very large transmission owner, basically operating two balancing areas across the West. So we have a Pacific Northwest area of our transmission system, as well as a system that serves our Rocky Mountain states. And part of that is hard investment in new transmission systems, putting in new lines and towers, but it also means looking at innovative solutions such as energy imbalance markets. And you'll see in the packet some information around that. Energy imbalance markets probably deserve their own 101. I don't think there's nearly enough time to go into that.
That's actually 201 or 301.
It might be a graduate level course at this point. But this morning we announced a partnership with the California Independent System Operator, so essentially California's transmission operator, to partner with PacifiCorp to explore how to better dynamically manage load supply balancing between those two systems. We think that the benefits to our customers can be substantial through this partnership, and this will absolutely help us better manage and integrate intermittent renewable resources, as well as be able to better manage reserve load needs. So think of it kind of as Match.com for electrons. We're going to see what we can do to put the computers together to be able to schedule at 5-minute intervals and hopefully provide some more efficiencies and some cost savings for our customers. The final area I'd like to briefly cover is just being able to position our business to best respond to greenhouse gas regulation. The company is committed to meeting all federal and state environmental compliance obligations, and we've done so in trying to make the most cost-effective decisions for our customers along the way. So for instance, we have committed to closing a coal plant in Utah by 2015. That decision didn't come easy, especially for the community that that coal plant is currently located in. But looking at what the cost would have been, similar to the Boardman situation that Marion just described, the cost of new regulations of what it would take to keep operating that plant versus what closing that plant and replacing that resource would be, for us it made sense for our customers to go down that path, and we have committed to doing so. We're also committing to changing in Wyoming a coal unit to natural gas, where we think that for the future operating of our system, again, weighing environmental compliance costs versus the cost of transitioning the gas in that particular unit, it makes sense for our customers, and we're going to pursue that. But additionally, we're looking ahead at this coming year and beyond, at where Federal Environmental Protection Agency regulation is underway, and that's included in the new source performance standard, as well as potential rulemaking as soon as this year around existing sources. And we believe that, you know, federal carbon regulation is upon us, and really our goal in responding to this is being able to engage our regulators as well as our customers and other stakeholders to make sure that whatever this federal overlay will be, however we have to manage our existing portfolio to meet new emissions requirements, has the least impact and the least economic cost for customers achievable. And so it's really going to be, how do we create a dialogue to make sure that we're responding in as much of a unified voice as we possibly can to really what's going to be, I think, pretty game-changing set of regulations that we expect coming from the EPA. I'll stop there. I'm sure people have questions. Thank you.
Quick question.
Mr. Johnson.
Scott, could you touch on the challenges you face in trying to expand your transmission capability? I'm sure you can't always go where you want to go, but I'm sure, I know I get in the weeds on the answer, but I'm sure the challenge is out there.
Yeah, thanks, Representative. Definitely, the rule of thumb is that to build a new high-voltage transmission line takes about 7 to 8 years from doing all the modeling and planning to think, yeah, we need a new transmission line, to getting the vendors and the engineering and equipment and materials and permitting that line to when you can actually put it in the service. We have had some recent successes. We just completed a year and a half ago a segment from southern Idaho into northern Utah, which is part of a reliability project. It's about 120 miles of transmission in that project. Came in at about $830-something million. I don't know the exact dollar amount, but that project constituted the single largest capital project in the company's history. So transmission is incredibly complicated. It's very expensive. And certainly when you impact communities along proposed routes, you're going to get a lot of attention to that project. We have a number of those in the Northwest right now where, you know, just going through the scoping and engagement with local communities on impact of where potential lines may go is a very exhaustive process.
Sure it is. Thank you.
Thanks. Just to set boundaries for the committee here in terms of expectations, I don't know why this session we're scheduled only until 4:45 instead of 5 o'clock, but it's my intention to go to 5 o'clock today. I think this is important information. I'd like to be able to get through the rest of the panel, so I hope that committee members will be able to stick around for that. Thanks.
I didn't know we were finished at 4:45.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my first and couple and only questions, and I'll be done. I could hit on a couple things. You're looking at partnering with California, and I've been actually working with power plant down in Riverside Power. And one of the problems they're having with wind energy, and I don't know if it's something you're running into, but they have a lot of turbines that they're taking offline, throwing online, back and forth. These are large machines, and they tend to spend a lot more on maintenance by doing this than if they just let them run. And they're finding that wind's giving them more problems. Now, they don't say that out in public like this, but I'm just wondering if you're running into the same issues with the wind and your regular turbines when they're trying to pick up the balance of the load.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Widener, it's a great question because I think you hit on exactly one of the challenges of operating a fleet of wind projects. On one hand, wind's great because it's frankly all capital. You don't pay for the fuel resource. Once you depreciate out the expense, it's a very low cost. It's really just operation and maintenance that is associated with that plant. The flip side is that it is intermittent. You can't dispatch it. You can't tell it when to operate, when not. Well, you can't tell it when not to operate. But generally, you don't have as much predictability as you would under, traditional fossil fuel-fired plants. So part of that is how do you manage the system around it to be able to accommodate that tendency, that intermittency? And that's where some of these market tools, such as the energy imbalance market, we think can be substantial in trying to address these concerns. So if a system, I'm not familiar with the particular system in California, but say a utility operating within its own system, and realize that there's 34 separate grids across just the western U.S. that different utilities are operating basically for their own use. If one system suddenly has too much wind at one point, and their only other option would be to turn down their wind, to be able to schedule on a 5-minute basis to call around basically to all the other systems, do you need power, and be able to schedule that power directly to somebody who needs it, means that you're optimizing that wind resource and you're meeting the load requirements for somebody else who otherwise might have to buy too much power, because you're always buying for peak. You're not necessarily buying for what your actual load is that shows up.
Then if I may follow up real quick. You can get this to us offline, but I'd actually kind of like to get the associated cost, because you're talking about taking coal plants offline right now that are depreciated out and pretty much paid for, and you just have to pay for the fuel because of regulations that's coming after you. I'd like to get the cost of pulling those offline, switching to the other power, what that's doing to the consumer, and I would like to get the cost of what it is with all the labor operators sitting waiting for power to drop to take these turbines off and online, and the added maintenance cost into it, if you have a way of putting that together, because I think that's something this committee needs to understand, because I've been in these plants and it's a huge expense, and it's the one that kind of people ignore. So anyway, I know you can't answer that right now, but I think it's something the committee needs to know.
It's a thoughtful question. I'll get you a thoughtful answer.
Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. I had a few slides, but I'm not going to take time to flip those on. So just quick background in terms of natural gas and the supply. If you think back, for those of you who might remember, just a few years ago, we were concerned about declining supplies and domestic supplies here in the United States, and looking at potentially importing natural gas from other countries. Basically, the shale play that's taking out across the United States, roughly about half of the U.S. Has capabilities for shale gas, which is changing the natural gas landscape considerably. Now some folks are estimating up to 100 years supply of natural gas just here in the United States. So that's made a big difference in the entire natural gas, and the questions about price. It's really had a big impact on price by driving it down, as has the economy as well. A couple of quick things. There's a little slide in there about the interstate pipeline system. Just kind of to point out to you that the West Coast is pretty sparse on that map, and the pipeline system was built out primarily around the original production areas. And so when you actually look at the supplies that come into Oregon, Portland and Willamette Valley they're one of the few metropolitan areas in the country that's served by a single transmission line, which is of concern to our company. For years, we've been looking at trying to find another route to connect the two interstate lines that go down through Oregon, one down through the valley, and the other one goes down through central Oregon. The third, I've listed in my handout the three companies, as did Jason Eistorfer. The three natural gas distribution companies, just to let you know, Avista, Cascade, and Northwest Natural also serve in the state of Washington in various points. We buy gas from producers. We pay the transmission companies to ship it to us, and then we put it into our system and distribute it to our customers. We purchase roughly two-thirds of our gas from Canada and a third out of the Rocky Mountains. The reason that storage is important is that we don't have enough pipeline capacity to serve our customers during the winter. So without storage, we don't have that capacity. To share with you the other mix a little bit, 60% of our customers are residential, 29% commercial, 4% have our industrial customers that have a firm contract, 4% are interruptible, which means during the winter we actually shut gas off to them if it gets too cold, and then we have some that are just transportation. All we do is they buy their gas somewhere else and we just move it for them to their facilities. Rates, just to give you a quick background on rates for natural gas utilities, consists of the commodity price, our expenses, and investments. And so we don't mark up the price of gas. Whatever we purchase gas for, we basically pass that on to our customers, which is why if you have natural gas, you will find that your rates are adjusted every year. They go up or they go down based on the market value of gas. We then also receive recovery in a general rate case for expenses as well as capital investments. And where we make our money is off of capital investments. Energy efficiency programs, as was mentioned, Avista operates its own programs. Cascade Natural Gas and Northwest Natural use the Energy Trust of Oregon. I don't know about the other utilities, but Northwest Natural is decoupled. What that means is that we don't earn any more or any less to recover our costs. So if a customer, that basically allows us to be neutral on energy efficiency. We don't lose any revenue if someone decides to do more energy efficiency measures. What we would suggest, not everybody agrees with this, is that the next step would be to look at incenting utilities to actually make capital investments in energy efficiency. Quickly, we believe natural gas is a clean resource. It's 50% fewer greenhouse gas emissions than coal, 30% fewer emissions than oil, and significantly fewer particulate and NOx emissions. It's also used to support renewable resources, and I think, again, the electrics have mentioned that they're building more of those, and you need some kind of a resource that you can turn on and turn off, dispatch, in order to accommodate the changes in wind or in solar. Finally, just some opportunities for natural gas, continued use of natural gas directly in space heating and home water heating, transportation sector, whether it be compressed natural gas for commercial vehicles, you can even get passenger vehicles, liquefied natural gas in terms of long-haul trucks, Freightliner in Portland, actually that's their test facility for, and they are testing liquefied natural gas, and most large manufacturers now produce a truck that will burn liquefied natural gas for over-the-road vehicles. Also, we're getting a lot of interest from marine and rail. Ships are now required going forward for clean air standards to, if you come into the territorial waters, you have to clean up your emissions. And so there are a number of companies that are looking to modify their ships, put in a natural gas engine, and then burn liquefied natural gas in that, and railroads. Railroads are the largest user of diesel fuel in the country. And finally, more locally, combined heat and power, which is basically where you generate power and then use the waste heat on site. And with that, I'll stop and answer questions, see if I kept within 5 minutes.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you very much for this panel. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. We look forward to decoupling 301 and capital investments in energy efficiency 450. We call forward Jason Fuser, David Markham, Michael, and Barbara Trout, please.
Member, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Do you have a PowerPoint?
I know. Whoever would like to begin, please.
Okay, I'll start. Chair Bailey and members of the committee, my name is Barbara Trout, and I'm on the board of the Tillamook People's Utility District. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon People's Utility District Association. OPUDA's members include five People's Utility Districts known as PUDs, which provide electric service in Oregon. We have supplied the committee with district maps showing the large territories we serve, which include nearly two-thirds of the Oregon coastline, parts of Columbia and Multnomah counties, Lane County, and as far east as Wasco County. In Oregon, PUDs are governed by five-member boards of directors that are elected by voters in each PUD service area to represent the communities we serve. All board meetings are open to the public. Each board sets rates based on the cost of providing service. Most of our power supply is provided by Bonneville Power Administration. Oregon's electric PUDs collectively serve over 193,000 Oregonians, annually delivering over 4 million megawatt hours of electricity. OPUDA member utilities provided 379 family wage jobs in rural communities last year, representing more than $46 million in salary and benefits, much of which stayed in our local communities. PUDs also pay property taxes and franchise fees. During 2011-12, we paid nearly $8 million in taxes and fees to the counties and cities we serve. Oregon PUDs provide their customers with electricity that is more than 93% carbon-free, which is one of the highest rates of clean energy in the United States. That 93% carbon-free power comes from the Bonneville Power Administration, including hydropower, wind, and power from the Columbia Generating Station. In addition, PUDs have developed our own renewable energy, which include cogeneration, wood waste, biomass, agricultural waste, landfill gas, and fish-friendly hydropower. Oregon PUDs also offer innovative energy solutions supporting renewable energy, such as solar and wind, energy efficiency programs, and conservation as a resource. PUDs have invested more than $46 million $1 billion in energy efficiency and conservation programs, which save more than 250 million kilowatt hours. A diverse mix of conventional and renewable power supply resources is crucial. A solid mix of power resources reduces operational and financial risk and helps PUDs maintain safe, reliable, and affordable service for customers now and into the future. Cost to customers is a critical consideration when determining what new power resources are truly sustainable and affordable to the public. Due to your leadership, our state has made significant investments in conservation and achieved tremendous energy savings. We already deploy the highest concentration of renewable generation in the country through the Pacific Northwest Columbia Snake River Federal Hydro System. Oregon PUDs are eager to serve as a resource to assist you with future energy and load growth planning. We have many energy experts on our team, and we know we can help you craft a balanced long-term energy plan for the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Trapp. Let's go through the panel committee and then we'll take questions.
Okay. Here we go. Good afternoon, Chair Bailey and members of the committee. I'm Dave Markham. I'm the president and CEO of Central Electric Cooperative, and we're headquartered in Redmond, Oregon. And I'm also the president of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, or the ORECA. I want to direct your attention to the map that I have here on the screen. I think you have a copy of it there. OREECA represents the state's 18 not-for-profit electric cooperatives and that serve 206,000 meters. And as you can see on the slide here, that also takes in 65% of the land mass of the state, 11% of the population, and we have more than 30,000 miles of transmission and distribution line that help us deliver electricity to the rural areas of Oregon. And you can see by the map that electric cooperatives serve some of the most rural areas of Oregon. And right, if I could direct you to the middle of the screen, and it's almost in an orangish red there, Central Electric Cooperative, my cooperative, is the largest co-op in the state. And we serve 32,000 meters that are spread out over 5,300 square mile service territory. From Hoodoo Ski Resort up on the top of San Juan Pass, I'm sure you know all where that is, all the way to the community of IZ, which is 154 miles to the east. And our service density is right at approximately 7 customers for every mile of distribution line that we have. Now, in the bottom right there, in the kind of the baby blue color, that's Harney Electric Cooperative. And they're one of the smallest electric cooperatives in the state, serving 3,900 members. And their service territory spans roughly 20,000 square miles. And I think I heard the representative from PG say their service territory was 4,000 square miles for the number of customers they serve. This is 20,000 square miles for 3,900 members. Harney's service density is less than half a customer per mile of distribution line. Now, in contrast, then, you've got Pacific Power and Portland General Electric, that their service density is right approximately 32 customers per mile of distribution line. The electric cooperative business model is really uniquely successful. Most Oregon electric cooperatives were formed 70 years or more ago, and they were created because investor-owned utilities did not want to serve the more rural areas that they didn't see as profitable. But if you receive service from an electric cooperative, you're both the customer that we serve and you're an owner of the company that provides that service to you. Co-ops are democratic. They're locally controlled organizations. They're controlled by their member owners who are involved in making decisions and setting policies. Elected representatives who serve as the board of directors, they're accountable to their membership. And really, the local control and the local decision-making, they're two of the key elements of why electric cooperatives operate so effectively and so efficiently. And keeping rates affordable for our members, it's a top priority for co-ops in a very difficult rural Oregon economy that in some areas of our service territories we're seeing double-digit unemployment rates. And this is why we're extremely concerned about any potential legislation that could increase costs back to the co-op and ultimately have to be passed on to our members through rate increases. Now, Oregon co-ops, they have a track record of environmental excellence, and we get almost all of the power that we provide to our members from the Bonneville Power Administration. This power is carbon-free, with 90% of it coming from the federal hydropower system, and roughly about 8% coming from the Columbia Generating Station. And since 1996, CEC and a number of other co-ops, we've been involved in the Coffin Butte Landfill Gas to Electricity Biomass Plant near Corvallis. We're also, CEC and a number of other co-ops are involved in a wave energy project off the Oregon coast near Reedsport. Across the state, electric cooperatives, we deployed smart grid technology to improve services, increase our reliability, and also to help control electricity costs for our members. In Oregon, 80% of the 206,000 meters that I mentioned earlier, those are smart meters from electric cooperatives. And in addition to the benefits that I mentioned before on the smart grid technology, this technology helps reduce already extremely low carbon footprint. CEC, we just completed deployment of 32,000 smart meters in December of last year, and this allows us to eliminate 160,000 vehicle miles that were traveled annually by this deployment. And electric cooperatives, we've long been innovators and trailblazers. We began energy conservation and efficiency decades ago, long before it became mainstream. And between 2001 and 2011, co-ops assisted their members with saving more than 343 million kilowatt hours of electricity through installation of these conservation and energy efficiency measures. Now, taking a quick look to the future, where are we going? Electric co-ops will continue an implementation plan, a very aggressive plan for continuing with conservation, energy efficiency, and renewable energy development. And we will leverage the capabilities of this smart grid technology. We'll analyze the potential for implementing demand response, time of use, and prepay programs that can help reduce energy costs for our members and in their usage. So, you know, from the inceptions in the 1930s and 40s, electric co-ops, they've really been problem solvers. And we can continue to solve the problems and the challenges that we face in the future if we can retain that local control and local decision-making that really has had a successful track record for the last 70-plus years. And I want to thank Chair Bailey and the committee for your interest and your effort in really wanting to gain a better understanding of the electric cooperative business model. And thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Michael.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Matt Michael. I serve the Canby Utility Board as general manager, and this year I'm serving the Oregon Municipal Electric Utility Association as president. So I'm appearing here on behalf of what we call OMU. And I'll start off walking you through our testimony just ever so briefly to respect your time. We are 11 Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. If you'll note on the back page there, we sort of place them geographically for you and give you a sense of when they're established. The municipal electrics are the oldest consumer-owned electrics in the state. And a lot of those stories are local stories of why a municipality, why citizens decided to take control of their destiny in delivering power. And what is unique to each of us yet common is that local control. And each of our boards serve as our local PUC, setting rates, establishing service standards, and hearing directly from the customers who are our governing body's neighbors.
Back up just a tiny bit.
Too close?
Yeah,
just
a little too close. Just a little less.
All right.
Thank you.
I want to quickly turn you to a map that we borrowed from the Bonneville Power Administration. It's a very colorful one, and in a way it's a bit of Where's Waldo here of finding the municipal electrics. They're the small dots. We are the dense areas of service for consumer-owned utilities. And you'll see that they're spread throughout the state, from Ashland to Drain to Forest Grove to McMinnville to Cascade Locks to Hermiston to Milton Freewater. And the part that I want to finally emphasize for you is that each of these utilities serve their communities in a unique and direct way that fits that community. Ashland is very aggressive in their solar program. Their community has told their electric department, we want that, we're interested in that. And so Ashland has been a standard bearer when it comes to implementing solar options for their customers. Forest Grove has taken advantage of solar in a different way, placing solar panels on one of their facilities in order to charge the city-owned electric vehicles. Milton Freewater has been a standard bearer when it comes to demand response. In other words, controlling their load by proactively controlling, say, like the water heaters in their customers' homes. So there are just three examples of these 11 municipally owned utilities responding to the local needs and concerns of their customers. Again, it's their neighbors informing their local utility boards, this is what we want to see. And so to echo the testimony you've heard from this panel, local control is key and critical for us. Having that ability to respond and measure policies on affordable rates and what is the future for this community in their power supply and power needs. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank all of you for taking the time to travel here to the Capitol to present today.
Actually, I was going to swap out with one other panelist.
Get you in a second.
Oh, okay.
And we'll come to you. So, any questions for these three, and then we'll go to Jason. Okay. Yeah, Representative Vega Peterson.
Yeah, I know we're running short on time, so I'm just kind of interested in hearing how you guys work together, your two organizations, because I noticed that it overlapped, and just kind of, and so maybe if you want to follow up with some information for me on that, that would be great.
Sure. Okay. As associations, we collaborate, but then also, I know just in the power industry, there are several regional associations that I know I'm always looking over other people's shoulders to see what's working, what's not, and what can I graft and bring to our community.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Thank you for the information, for making the trip. Mr. Huser, why don't you come on up? And at the same time, if Margie Harris and Jeff Bissonette would come up. Colleagues, I understand if you have to leave, I want to make sure that we're giving the time to those that traveled here, even though we're going over. So thank you all for your patience on this.
Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Huser, Government Relations Manager for the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I'm going to run through very quickly a highlight version. I hope it's not too disjointed. EWEB is Oregon's largest consumer-owned utility with 88,000 customers, about 300 average megawatt load. We're governed by five publicly elected officials. We are very similar to the other consumer-owned utilities you just heard from, except for one significant factor from a fuel supplier perspective. We actually only get half our power from the Bonneville Power Administration, and we self-supply the other 50%, so we're an anomaly there. That would be more common in the state of Washington, but I think we're the only consumer-owned in Oregon with that type of profile. We actually have three dams on the McKinsey River, so we are largely still a hydro-based utility. We also have a smattering in there of wind, dating back to 1997 with our first project. Conservation, we consider that part of the fuel mix pie. We've actually acquired 65 average megawatts since 1981 when we started our conservation department. That's a nice size virtual power plant. We also have a smattering of solar, biomass, and cogeneration. A significant program we have at EWEB is we have a customer loan program to finance energy efficiency. It's a zero interest loan program. It's been very popular with customers. We've loaned out quite a bit of money over the years. And actually, two co co-ops, a PUD, and a municipal down in Lane County also have adopted that same approach. So there's some cross-pollination with that type of loan program. We also are the first and only consumer and utility that's in the primary 25% by 2025 standard of the RPS. So we join our investor-owned colleagues in that primary standard. Looking ahead to the future, I think some of the issues UWEB sees on our horizon. First off, rate pressures. We're actually a surplus utility. We have more power than we need. And in a time of flat load growth and soft wholesale power prices, that has not been an ideal scenario for us to be in. So that's a challenge dealing with rate pressures. I think also two things we see on the horizon that are challenges is meeting peak demand needs and also integrating renewables. You've heard that from other speakers. We have that same issue. We're actually involved with a really neat pilot project. I hope sometime this committee can hear about it in the future. It's with the Bonneville Power Administration trying to deploy what's known as electric thermal storage. It's basically the idea of superheating hot water like around 3 a.m. During light load using wind from a wind signal. And the idea is in a very insulated tank, you keep that water very hot, and then there's a mixing valve with cold water so that at 7 a.m. That water mixes to the appropriate household temperature, and you've reduced peak demand, and you've also hopefully accomplished integration of renewables. It's sort of a primitive battery, if you will, for wind energy. That's one tool that's in the toolbox of addressing integration of renewables. I can stop by and tell some of you about that if you'd like to hear more about it sometime, and I'll conclude my remarks there so those are short for time.
Thank you very much. And I think the committee would be interested to see any information you have on it if you want to forward it on.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Chairman Bailey and members of the committee. You're in an endurance contest today of how much can you absorb in one meeting about the field of energy. I appreciate being here today. My remarks are summarized, and you have them in this folder that I believe is now being passed out, and there's some for the audience as well. So you have a copy of the slide presentation, and you have more detail included in the folder. I will breeze through because of time limitations, and be pleased to come back at another time as needed. We are an independent nonprofit organization. We grew out of state legislation passed in 1999, Senate Bill 1149, which created the public purpose charge. As you've heard today, we serve 1.5 million customers. It's most of the gas customers in the state of Oregon and about 75% of the electric customers in the state. We do also coordinate with the public entities and utilities that are serving our gas customers, so there's some synergy in between our electric and our gas customers. Everything funding Energy Trust is from a customer of one of the four investor-owned utilities, PGE, Pacific Power, Northwest Natural, and Cascade Natural Gas. In the packet, there's a map of our service territory, like others you've seen today. It's representative of different parts of the state. It's not contiguous, and it creates a lot of diversity and challenge for us to serve all parts of the state who contribute to and benefit from Energy Trust programs. Our structure is described on slide 4, and basically I just wanted to highlight a couple aspects of what's depicted there. We are a very open and transparent organization. We function largely like a public entity, even though we are a nonprofit entity. So our meetings are open to the public. We have advisory councils on both renewable energy and on conservation. We're very inclusive and dependent upon stakeholder input and other input to shape our programs and design them and to provide feedback and delivery about them. We are accountable to both our board of directors and to our Public Utility Commission staff and commissioners who have oversight responsibilities for the Energy Trust. And we work directly with customers and directly with the market actors to deliver our services and programs, most of whom are small businesses who provide services like installing insulation in people's homes. And they represent the jobs that we help create and the economic development benefits that we also contribute to. There's a slide here about the PUC's oversight roles and responsibilities. You've heard that we have a direct contract relationship with the Public Utility Commission, and some other slides that Jason Eisendorfer showed you earlier depict the other ways in which we work with the PUC. I think what's very important to emphasize there is there are public meetings regarding our performance measures. There are public meetings about our proposed budget and action plan, public meetings about our management audit findings and our financial audits and other ways of measuring our performance. The energy efficiency is the cheapest resource that we can purchase. It's also the most benign from an environmental perspective. We are delivering power at 3 cents a kilowatt hour on the electric side. So there's lots of headroom between that kilowatt hour saved and the next cheapest resource, which is 6.6 cents that you saw in Lisa Schwartz's presentation, derived from natural gas. So we are currently meeting almost all of the load growth of the utilities and endeavoring to do more of that on a consistent and ongoing basis. The three things Energy Trust provides are assistance to customers about what can I do to save energy in my home or how can I access renewable energy. We're providing them with technical assistance to answer the questions and to tailor our programs to meet their needs. And we're also providing financial incentives, rebates on things like the purchase of energy efficient appliances and more recently loans. There are several slides here that give you the specifics of the programs that we are dealing with and delivering for all of our energy efficiency customers and for renewable energy. I might highlight that we serve the needs of customers through five different renewable energy technologies. This is an important portion of what we do, but 91% of what we do is around energy efficiency, and that is the emphasis of what we deliver. Slide 12 summarizes what we have done over time. We celebrated our 10-year anniversary last year, and we have built an energy efficiency power plant in the state of Oregon. And you can kind of imagine that as an entity out there that is providing the lowest cost power and delivering all the benefits associated with that benign resource. We serve thousands of customers every year. We'd be happy to share with you the specifics of what we have done in your specific legislative districts. The statistics I am most proud of is that we have directly contributed to the savings of $1 billion on the utility bills of customers who have participated in our programs. $1 billion. In addition to that, there have been independent analyses presented to this body at the legislature indicating that we've contributed $2.1 billion to the Oregon economy. And when we're investing in energy efficiency and renewable energy, we are avoiding having to invest $1.57 billion because we don't need to build storage capacity, transmission capacity, distribution, fuel acquisition. All of those things are deferred. There's one summary slide in here talking about the advantages of being a mission-driven organization with stable, committed, dedicated funding. Again, I thank you for the time you've given today to this important subject, and I'm available as a resource to you throughout your deliberations. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Harris. Mr. Bissonnette, if you'll wrap us up quickly, that would be wonderful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette. I represent the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities in the state. Touching on all of the utilities you've seen here today, except for the consumer-owned utilities, we also work on telecommunications issues, and we can open up a whole other discussion about that. One of the tough parts of being the last person is that everybody has said what needs to be said. I just haven't said it, so I'll be very quick. First of all, with CUB, we are a membership-based organization. We exist in state law as the recognized representative of residential ratepayers. We were founded through a ballot measure initiative in 1984. We are a nonprofit organization that, as I said, is membership-based. We look at that recognizing that we can't afford to do everything we want. We can't really even afford to do everything we need to do all at the same time. And so we're really focused on prioritizing investments by the utilities on behalf of their customers and making sure that we make the highest value investments in the right order at the right time to really bring value to the ratepayers. And that's really what we look at. We don't necessarily say, you know, low rates at all costs, but really what does bring the best value to ratepayers. Some of the top issues that we look at, of course, are fair, just, and reasonable rates. We look a lot at investments in energy efficiency, building on the very fine system that we have that is centered on the Energy Trust of Oregon. As we look at other proposals for more energy efficiency, we really ask what more can we get that we're not already getting and how much are we paying for it? And, you know, energy efficiency is good, but expensive and unnecessarily expensive energy efficiency is not so good, and we ask those questions. We look at investments in renewables, making sure that we have a good balance of reliable power and clean power, and going toward a more flexible energy system. And we've also been doing a lot of work on coal investments and making sure that what we do invest in coal plants is needed and cost effective. But as we've seen in the Boardman situation, there are maybe some investments we make, but close down early, and that actually saves customers money and frees up money that can be made for other investments. For this session, we're going to be, I think, in front of you a lot with a lot of business. First and foremost, there are some easy things that we can do for energy efficiency, like setting appliance efficiency standards. That's going to be a bill that's starting over in the Senate, and we'll be coming.
Mr. Bissonnette, we could probably run through the legislative agenda on a fact sheet.
We will do that, and so I will look forward to talking about those issues with you as we move forward. And I thank you for your time here.
Great, thank you very much. Any questions for this panel?
Just a quick one,
Representative
Margie Harris. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are the five technologies that you mentioned?
They're all renewable technologies, so it's solar, it's biopower, it's small-scale hydro, geothermal, and small-scale wind. Mm-hmm. Different than what the utilities do through their RPS, by the way. Small-scale.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Committee, thank you for sticking around for extra time. We'll try not to do this very often. I hope this was useful, folks. Thank you all to the presenters that came prepared today. So hopefully it was helpful, and look forward to follow-up. That committee is adjourned.
Thank God there's not a